I'll announce them. Good afternoon. I'm going to open the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Thursday, April 16th. Quickly, I'm going to make a couple of announcements about bills we're going to be carrying over in case folks are here just for those bills. So I'm going to carry over House Bill 2617. I'm going to carry over House Bill 2252, carry over House Bill 2599, and carry over House Bill 3248. So if you're here for any of those, your number has been called and you're free to go. There you go. See? Don't cheer on your way out, please. 358. Excuse me? We don't need to carry that. That's not like necessary because it's not under the deadline. Okay, so with that, I'm going to open a, really for the purposes of hearing from Senator Farioli, so it should, we just didn't post it for public hearing, but we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2019, and Senator Farioli has a dash one he wants to present. Wendy, you'll give us a quick reminder of what this bill was about. We heard it on Tuesday.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2019 expands the membership of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission from 7 to 9 members as of July 1st, 2016. The bill specifies a method for selecting members and provides a procedure for the executive director of the commission to conduct a preliminary review phase of ethics complaints and limits the period of time review to 30 days. The bill also requires the commission to make complaints filed, motions acted upon, and findings issued searchable on the internet on or after January 1st, 2017. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Welcome, Senator. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, State Senator Ted Farioli, and I have to commend the chair. Normally, I would have to pick up a guitar to clear the room as quickly as you did with a single announcement. So, that is a skill I very much envy. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to present the Dash 1 amendments to 2019. We have negotiated with and worked hard to try to make an amendment supported by Governor Brown and the Senate Republican Caucus, which does three things. First, the governor's original bill did expand from 7 to 9 the membership of the commission, but we argued, I think, successfully with the governor that to help her accomplish her goal of bringing more balance to the appointments to the commission, we opined and offered the amendment that each of the caucuses should appoint 2 members. For a total of 8, leaving the governor with the 9th appointment, and that would very much more engage the legislative branch in the issue of ethics. The second part of that amendment was that no more than 3 members could be from the same party. And the theory there is that if you want to broaden the representation, what you do is make sure that you leave room for the unaffiliated, independent, and other minor parties which are growing in Oregon. So we would have at least a couple of appointees that would come neither from the Republican or the Democrat registration rolls. Then the other thing would be to make sure that the ethics filings are not used as an anvil or a hammer in politics, in political campaigning. And so posting requirements would be limited to final judgments rather than to allegations or charges pending before the commission. So at the end of the day, frivolous references to complaints and misleading advertising that Representative so-and-so was subject to numerous ethics complaints would probably not follow because we would limit the postings to the final judgments. So, you know, the idea is perhaps a final judgment is fair game, but a listing of allegations that were never decided or were successfully concluded in favor of the person accused, that just does not become grist for the political mill. We would like to reiterate our desire to work with the governor and legislators from both parties, not only to work on this bill and the Dash 1 amendments, but also to give full consideration to proposals from the House, including House Bill 3331, 3505, 2790, 2791, and 3043, and Senate bills that also touch on the same issues, which would be Senate Bill 762, 852, 853, and 854, and 940. So, you know, we're down for ethics, Madam Chair. We would like to start with this amendment. And thank you so much for allowing me to come and present the amendment, since I was not able to appear earlier on this important bill.
Thank you. And just as a note, colleagues, I want to note that Senator Farioli was not able to attend previously because the Senate floor went long. So that was why he was unable to attend previously. So questions for the Senator on his Dash 1 amendment?
Thank you, Chair Feng and Senator Farioli. I just want to be clear that someone not registered in a political party is eligible to be on the Ethics Commission.
Madam Chair, and to the question from the Vice Chair, my understanding is that membership would be at the behest of the caucuses, and they would be choosing citizens to represent all different kinds of affiliations. And then, of course, the governor would have the ninth appointment. But no party would have the ability to stack the commission, and that's the point.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But the language is a little bit unclear, where it says no more than three members maybe members of the same political party. But what happens if someone's not at all a member of a political party? Could they still be?
Madam Chair, to the question of the Vice Chair, unaffiliated members could serve.
Okay. Do we need clarification of that?
Madam Chair, I don't know how I could make it more clear. There are independents, and there are other minor parties, perhaps, and then there are unaffiliated. If unaffiliated are nominated, they could be confirmed and serve.
Representative McLean?
Well, I am not as familiar with the other section, which was your amendment dealing with they have to be filed judgments, or they were final judgments?
Final judgments,
final
ma'am.
Judgments.
Final orders and judgments,
okay.
Not allegations or pending
okay.
charges.
Other questions? Yes.
I just want to say I appreciate the amendments. I was a victim of that. I had somebody file some frivolous charges against me in OGEC that I was later exonerated from, and those made it to the papers and everything. It was a typical political attack that you're talking about. So I personally appreciate that amendment.
And Madam Chair, I think there must be some unwritten rule of journalism that requires the charges to be on page one, and the resolutions in favor of the person charged are on like 11B.
Yeah.
So, you know, down in the lower right-hand corner next to the lost dog ad.
Yeah.
So thank you for that question, Representative and Madam Chair.
Further questions? I just had one real
yes,
quick.
Ma'am.
So I think further vet out Representative Buehler's question. So a non-affiliated person is not actually in a party. So there could not be more than three members of the Constitution Party and not more than three members of the Democratic Party. But there, in theory, could be seven people who are non-affiliated on the Ethics Commission, right? Because they're not actually in a party, so there wouldn't be more than three members from any party.
Yes, Madam Chair, you point out an anomaly. However, I have difficulty believing that the caucus leaders would appoint people that are completely disconnected. So the limitation tends to be just to make sure we don't have more than three of any stripe. But I can't imagine that all four caucus leaders would appoint unaffiliated members.
Thank you. And the other quick question is, I noticed that it says that no more than three members can be members of the same party. So if there was, I mean, again, just trying to think out situations, because these are four-year terms, if somebody was maybe appointed and they were a non-affiliated person and at some point they changed their party registration and suddenly there were four Republicans or four Democrats on the panel, would that person then have to be taken off? Or would is it not that they, is it at the time of their appointment they can't be more than three members of the
Chair,
party?
To that excellent question, I think that is an issue that would come before the Rules Committee, and it would be a matter of the appointing authority. The question would be brought by the appointments secretary. And typically what happens is if a conflict develops in the appointing process, then that's resolved before the appointment is made.
Okay, so they wouldn't have to end their term midterm. It would be like when the next appointment was up.
What typically would happen would be the nominee would be vetted, and then the question would be asked, does that comport with the requirements? And if it doesn't, then the nominee would not be confirmed.
Okay, so I just want to make it clear that if the person was already confirmed and then during their term changed their party registration, the language here looks like they wouldn't be able, like that there would then be, it would be in violation of statute because there would be four Republicans or four Democrats.
Yeah.
But it sounds like your intent is to say that
it
just would be at the time that they were reappointed,
yes,
they could
ma'am.
Not.
For the record, that's the intent.
Okay. I mean, yeah, okay, cool. And then just colleagues, the Dash 1 amendment is Senator Farioli's amendment. The Government Ethics Commission had some technical kind of recommendations that the governor accepted, so that's the Dash 2. So in my understanding, the Dash 3 amendment is the combination of Senator Farioli's amendment and the Government Ethics Commission. So it really what we would actually be considering would be the Dash 3, and is that your understanding as well?
Yes, Madam Chair, and we commend that to the wisdom of the committee.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And I guess since we're on this bill, is there anyone else who came today to be heard on House Bill 2019? Okay. Anyway, I don't think we're quite ready to adopt the amendments. We do have the paperwork. Okay. Let's stand at ease for a moment. I just don't know. So we are going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2019. And all right, with that, if there's everyone is here, we might as well, colleagues, we're planning to move House Bill 3321 and 3322 to rules. Perhaps during discussion, you can note just kind of that you're in a work group and then we're not, don't necessarily have time to move those before the deadline. So with that, I'm going to open a work session, House Bill 3321. You want to give us a reminder of that bill?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. House Bill 3321 requires contracting agency to publish certain information about public contracts on the Oregon Transparency website, requires the contractor to provide certain information to the contracting agency, and for the contracting agency to treat the information as a public record subject to disclosure under public record laws. There are also other provisions related to what needs to be required in a public contract. The bill would become operative January 1st, 2016. It declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3321 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, but that it be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 3321 to the floor without recommendation as to passage and be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion?
Yeah. And Madam Chair, I would just note that we're currently involved in a work group and have not, at this time, drafted amendments to the bill, which is what we're hoping to do. And so the extension going to rules is very helpful.
All right. Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Nierman.
Can I request just a short little recess to confer with you on procedure here?
Certainly. Thanks. We'll stand at ease for a moment. Okay. Okay, and we're back, and we are in work session on Senate House Bill. Keep doing the
Senate House Bill.
House Bill 3321. That's okay. And we were in a motion to move it to the floor without recommendation as to passage and be referred to the Committee on Rules, and we are in discussion. So, Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some reservations about this bill. I'm in favor of transparency, but I have some reservations about this as to how it's going to affect the market. So I understand it's going to get some rework in rules, but so I reserve the right to vote yes on the floor, but I'll be a no vote out of committee.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Stark.
And Chair Fagan, thank you for your patience with those of us freshmen who are learning the process on this. I'm in the same camp as Nierman. I think I'm actually okay with moving it to rules without recommendation, but I definitely have concerns with the bill as written. So.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, Debbie, please call the roll.
Representative McGlynn?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Representative Starr?
Yes.
Representative Hobie?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bueller?
No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. All right, with that, it goes to rules, and I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3321 and open a work session on House Bill 3322. And you want to give us a summary of this one as well?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3322 requires a contracting agency to conduct a study on how potential procurements will affect the local area in which the work connected to the procurement will occur. It requires the contracting agency to provide to the employees or their employees' representative the results of a cost analysis and an opportunity to provide an alternative cost analysis. Requires a contracting agency to demonstrate that a procurement will result in at least 10% cost savings and that the contractor will pay employees equivalent wages and benefits to those that are received by public the agency's employees. It becomes operative January 1st, 2016.
Thank you. I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3322 to the floor without recommendation as to passage and that it be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Representative Rayfield moves House Bill 3322 to the floor without recommendation as to passage and be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion?
And I would just note again that this is, along with House Bill 3321, one of the two bills that we're still working on in our work group to come to a solution, get some amendments to get to reach the goal of what the bill's really trying to do.
Okay. Further discussion?
Yeah. I have some similar reservations about this, so I'll be behaving the same way.
Okay. So. Any other discussion? Okay, Debbie, please call the roll.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Representative
Starr?
No.
Representative Bowie?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bueller?
No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Yes. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3322. And let's see where we're at. Open, or I'm already on 3099. And open a work session, House Bill 3099. And Representative Holby, did you want to present your committee, your amendment down there or up here?
No, here's mine. And I don't know if Das is in the room. I don't see Das around, but I know Sean McSpaden's here who can probably review this. I think we did sort of review this previously. So the Dash 2 amendment does not create a separate agency as the office of this CIO or Chief Information Officer, but does transfer authority over policy around IT contracts and IT contracting and gives authority to the CIO for reviewing and approving and basically curing the IT contracts themselves. So it does take approval from the CIO, the Chief Information Officer, to do that. I've been working for a couple of years on this, along with a lot of help from Legislative Fiscal Office and DAS and Legislative Council, trying to provide some more accountability in specifically our IT contracting process and our IT contracts. And so there's a very integrated system that DAS has adopted with some checkpoints, I guess they're called gates, for some incremental reviews of contracts along the way. And so this bill complements that in that it does give the CI, Chief Information Officer, the ability to, have those reviews, to actually require his approval as these contracts move forward and make sure that they achieve their purposes, have the quality that we expect and accountability that we expect in the process. And I think DAS has, I can't speak for them directly, but they have indicated to me that they are in agreement with the DASH 2 amendment and making this pretty large incremental step to having some accountability for information technology contracts in the state of Oregon. I think it is something that we have struggled with for years, as we all know. And I think this is a huge step. There is also a DASH 4 amendment in OLIS that was under consideration, though we haven't fully vetted that with the governor's office and DAS, but we have had conversations around it that accomplishes the same thing but also transfers the operations of some of the IT projects within DAS to the chief information officer as well. And I'm hoping when this bill goes to Ways and Means, they will have another look at that amendment and discuss it as well, but quite comfortable moving the DASH 2 amendment with a due pass recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you.
And I don't know if you have more specific questions about it, since I'm not looking at my spreadsheet on it at the moment. I could dig it out, but Sean McSpaden knows this by heart as well, and I know he's here if people have further questions of the policy.
Okay. Well, I was thinking about just going into a motion, but would anyone prefer that I have Sean come up first, or should we just proceed?
Okay.
I'll entertain a motion on the DASH 2.
All right, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the DASH 2 amendments to House Bill 3099, dated April 15, 2015.
Representative Rayfield has moved to adopt the DASH 2 amendments to House Bill 3099, dated April 15, 2015. Is there any discussion? Yes.
So I'm going to be a troublemaker today. I appreciate the work that Representative Holvey's done on this. I think the introduced bill and the amendments both go in the right direction, and so I'm supportive of both of them. I think I like the introduced bill more than I like the amendment, but I prefer both of them to the status quo. So I think we're in the right direction. We have two kinds of things that need to be fixed. One of them is where we have a Cover Oregon situation where we have kind of a lack of accountability, and both the amended version and the introduced version move us in the right direction on that. The other thing that's a problematic thing is when you have a situation where the governor's making political decisions or making policy decisions based on politics, and both the amended version and the introduced version go in the right direction. I think the introduced version creates a little bit of a stronger presence of the chief information officer, and I'd prefer to have that myself, but I'm supportive of both. I'm going to just vote against the amendment just because I prefer the introduced, but I just want to be on record as saying that that both of these, that either one of these is preferable to the status quo.
Thank you. Further discussion? Okay, Debbie, please call the roll.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Representative Holvey?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Vice Chair Buehler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. Okay, and that's going, we'll do a motion.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3099 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Rayfield has moved the House Bill 3099 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank all the agencies who really helped us along, and I see Alex Pettit, the Chief Information Officer, also in the room, who's been helpful in this process as well. And since I see one of the co-chairs of Ways and Means in the room too, I will reiterate that I do hope that Ways and Means and the Chief Information Officer and DAS also consider the DASH 4 amendment, which does move some of the operational responsibilities to the Chief Information Officer. I know it's a maybe a little bit larger of a incremental step that would make some uncomfortable. I think it would provide some more expertise inside the Chief Information Office that I think would be beneficial. So with that, I appreciate appreciate that. And urge an aye vote. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Further discussion, Representative Rayfield.
I would just like to note to Representative Hovey that we also have our vice co-chair here from Ways and Means.
Oh, yes.
I wouldn't want her to be left out.
Yes. My mistake. Sorry.
Further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Hovey?
Aye.
Representative
McLean? Aye.
Representative Nearman?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Buehler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. Okay, and that's going to Ways and Means. So I will close the work session, House Bill 3099. And I'm just going to do that now. And open the public hearing in House Bill 3523. And Wendy, do you want to...
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3523 reorganizes the mission and governance of the State Library, changes the name of the trustees of the State Library to the State Library Board, changes the composition and number of the board members, and provides for the governor, rather than the trustees of the State Library, to appoint the State Librarian. It establishes a State Reference Coordinating Council consisting of the State Librarian, State Archivist, and State of Oregon Law Librarian to coordinate interagency delivery of services between state agencies and ensure collaboration. The bill provides for the State Library to approve selection, purchase, and maintenance of databases and subscriptions for state agencies and to certify state agency libraries maintained separate from the State Library. And there are a couple of amendments that are posted on OLIS for the bill.
Okay, great. We'll have Senator Devlin, Representative Buckley, and Representative Nathanson to say.
Madam Chair, if I could, I'd just like to make a transparency statement. My son-in-law works for the State Library, and so I don't think I have a conflict of interest, but I just would like to be on the record being transparent about
Thank
that.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
We always let our elder go first, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to guess who that is.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The three of us are here today to testify in favor of House Bill 3523. One of us, not Representative Buckley or myself, has had the good fortune to serve on, I believe, at least two work groups relative to the State Library. I don't believe Representative Buckley and I have served on any. But our experience with this, I think, really started in earnest in 2013 when the governor recommended a one-year budget for the State Library. Actually, he recommended a one-year budget for two agencies, the Department of Housing and the State Library. I believe that that recommendation was warranted in housing, although it caused some issues, but there were a lot of issues to resolve within housing that needed to be resolved. And I think that agency is now functioning well. And I think if I go to the other agency that received a one-year budget, I think that agency is doing a fairly good job of doing what Oregonians expected to do. I think, though, that the reality is that there may need to be some changes made in the structure of that agency. What we've tried to do in Ways and Means is we've taken some of the recommendations from the last work group, the ones that were consensus, and put them into this bill. We were planning after the 14th session, actually, to have another work group on this issue. The difficulty became that there are a lot of other issues that arose, and we really had a hard time getting anybody that actually wanted to serve on another work group. The second issue, and I'm sometimes pretty blunt, and that's not necessarily a good trait, the executive branch that had made the recommendation for this, and I'm not speaking about the State Library or their staff, I'm talking about the governor's office that had made their recommendation for this, walked away from the issue and basically left the legislature with the issues that they had created. It doesn't create a very significant issue, but I think it's been hard for, in that first year of this biennium, for the employees there because there was actually no budget for the second year. We actually had to put in place that budget for the second year. Oddly enough, it causes a little bit of oddities because that second year, since it's an addition to the adopted budget, doesn't roll up in current service level, so we had to put the money back in. For the State Library for current service level. But the recommendations that are here are pretty much consensus recommendations between all the parties that were in these work groups, with two exceptions. And those two exceptions, I think, are important. One of the things is that we believe it's important that the chief executive, the governor, actually appoint the state librarian as the head of an agency, which the governor does in most cases, though not all. But I think in this particular case, I think it's important that the governor actually be able to appoint who is the librarian. The second is a change in composition of the board. That's largely because the board serves kind of a different purpose than your local library. I love librarians. I think everybody at this table loves librarians. But the state library serves other libraries, basically, is one of the things. It serves some people with special needs. It serves other people occasionally with reference questions, or more than occasionally. But it serves other libraries, and it serves state agencies. So we think its board should actually represent, to some degree, its client base, the people that are actually utilizing it. We also think that it should actually also retain some purely public members, and that's what we've attempted to do in this bill. I didn't come with prepared comments, though I'm speaking too long. The other thing I think that we'll talk, and you'll have some testimony, maybe you won't once Representative Nathanson. I never really understood why the state law library was even in this discussion, other than the fact that it has library in its name. So I never really understood why it was in this discussion at all. But I think there will be an amendment to actually take them out of this bill. So I will close it at that. We didn't want Representative Nathanson to appear here by herself, and we wanted to make it very clear that the bill that's before you was supported by both co-chairs.
I hope I someday have a bill for both the co-chairs of Ways and Means decide that they want to come down and support me.
Can I get a picture of this?
It'll be one with no fiscal impact.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. I am here simply to offer my support. Representative Nathanson has been at the center of the discussions on the state library for several years now. She has done more work on this subject than anyone else in the legislature. Her intent is to try to make sure the state library is strong moving forward. I support the work she's done. I think she's come up with Senator Devlin's, as a consultant, come up with a good plan, and LFO has been working with her step-by-step on this as well. So I'm just here to support the bill and my colleague.
And thank you. Love this librarian too.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. Oh, come on. This is hard. Thank you very much to the co-chairs of Joint Ways and Means for being here today. This bill was the product of a lot of thought. It is not my bill. It is a bill brought to you by the Joint Ways and Means process. After several years of brainstorming ideas for library transformation to meet 21st century needs of the state agencies and the public, there seemed to be some hurdles still to overcome. We were always on the brink of change. It just hadn't quite happened yet. Thank you, Senator Devlin, for mentioning the state law library. It was never intended to be part of the discussion or the subject of change, and I'm pleased that there is an amendment prepared for you. As the senator and the representative have mentioned, not only was there a long process, but there was a lot of conversation about what is the mission of the state library, since it's different from a local library. Indeed, the state library supports not only all state agencies, it supports us as legislators with legislative research. It's also supporting the work of over 250 local libraries. Those are municipal and county and other libraries. There were previous work groups. Results of those work groups were often lists, like a to-do list. Some of those items were accomplished, but not the majority. A solution evolved over 2014, the last half of last year, to reshape the library's board and the appointment of the director so that it could more clearly match its 21st century mission. and to remove the legislature from becoming involved in a host of operational details. These details include all sorts of things, like what is the appropriate way to store and provide access to materials, both print materials, electronic materials. I shouldn't say both. There's many different formats of materials. You have tape. There are discs available. There's so many different formats, and some of those, for example, microfiche, there may not even be a microfiche reader anymore. If a library borrows something, there may be no reader to read the material. So there were many questions about what is the appropriate place to store materials, who's responsible for providing public access to the materials, who's responsible for answering questions, whether it's research questions or just how do I find this questions. And I think that that was well beyond what a legislative work group should have been involved in, and I'm very pleased that you have something in front of you today that I think will serve us well to last 4 years to come.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, questions for this panel? Yes, Representative McLean.
It's hard to ask questions of this panel because they're just so perfect on so many different levels of being prepared. But what I did want to ask was, when you're talking about the relationship between the county and the city libraries, and then also really and truly this body, the improvements in those areas, was there something on that wish list of things that needed to be done? I mean, did that work group get into actually some of that brainstorming?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to read from you just a few items from the reorganization report that was issued in 2013 to illustrate that, yes, these types of activities were discussed. Support for local libraries. It says the state library should supply ample support to local libraries through the various functions listed below: collecting and reporting library statistics, continuing education programs, that's both virtual and in-person trainings for librarians and paraprofessional staff, Library Services and Technology Act grants, that's federal money that comes to the state year after year, and local libraries apply. The state library is responsible for reviewing and distributing funds. The Oregon School Library Information System, or OSLIS, mm-hmm. State Library is involved in that. The Ready to Read grant program, Talking Book and Braille Services, and Plinkett. So those are an example of activities contemplated that need to continue, and what's the appropriate way to do that.
Other questions? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. So, Representative Nathanson, are you convinced that there's an adequate definition of the roles between the Oregon State Library, the Oregon State Archives, and the, I'm not sure what it's called, but let's say the archiving function of the Secretary of State's office, that there's adequate divisions between those and that there's not significant overlap among those?
Madam Chair and Representative Nierman, there have been discussions about where there might be overlap, but also where there might be gaps. One agency might think another one's going to take care of something. You need to make sure that you aren't leaving gaps as well. I'm convinced that enough discussions have happened over the last 3 years that if there are any overlaps remaining, that there is work in progress to eliminate the overlap. There are materials that are collected by state agencies, but the state library in the past has also had responsibility, for example, as a federal depository library. The citizens of Oregon have access to federal materials, for example. How will they continue to have access to those materials? They're not state materials, which have been generally some of that is cared for by the state archivist, which is in the Secretary of State's office, but how you work out the appropriate delineation of responsibilities, there have been plenty of conversations, and I trust that our professional librarians and our professional staff in the different agencies will continue to watch for places to keep their functions aligned appropriate to what their mission is, because as you've mentioned, yes, there are several agencies that touch this issue of materials, either official materials, or there have even been discussions about what do you do with historical materials. It may be about Oregon in its early days. It's historical material, but it wasn't necessarily published by a state agency, or it may be genealogical material. Is the state responsible for that? Is some other organization responsible? And to that extent, the Oregon Historical Society has also been a player in the conversation and the subject of discussion. What role does OHS play in preserving Oregon's history?
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thanks. I was just wanted to double check about the amendments. So there's a dash 2 and a dash 1, and I assume that they're both, they don't conflict with each other, and you'd be adopting both of those amendments?
Madam Chair, we're looking for
LFO staff here.
Agency staff to confirm.
Come up here and ignore it. LFO staff's not there.
Well, we can answer that later, I suppose.
That's right.
It appears they don't really conflict with each other. I was just wanting to make sure that, you know, we're adopting both of those amendments.
Madam Chair and Representative Holvey, yes, there was a need for some clarification that resulted in one amendment, and then when it was recognized that the state law library was inadvertently swept into this work, we needed to take care of that, and that happened at a separate time.
Thank you. That's sort of the way I read it, and I really appreciate all the work you've done, and am really, you know, I don't see very often the Joint Committee on Ways and Means proposing policy bills, but really happy to see that.
Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next we'll hear from Janet Webster. And actually, I'm going to also have one more person, because I think there's two right here, I think so. Yeah, how about Janet Webster and then Phil Lehman and Catherine Bowie?
Who wants to go first? A little bit of a tough act to follow. I'm Janet Webster. I am the chair of the Oregon Library Association's Legislative Committee, and thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee. The Oregon Library Association is the state's professional organization representing school, public, academic, library staff, trustees, volunteers. I'm here. Most of my colleagues are down in Eugene at our annual conference. The Oregon Library Association supports the spirit of this bill, and we're really pleased that it recognizes OLA as a stakeholder in the functioning of the state library. I think the revision, as Representative Nathan says, is a positive step because it positions the state library to move forward and be more effective in providing and anticipating the information needs of state government. We also like the bill in that it retains the elements of the core mission that are very important to the library community, those being the expertise the state library has in early literacy in particular, the infrastructure that for providing services to the vision impaired. Most public libraries do not have that type of capability, and we rely on the state library. The synthesis of library statistics, which sounds very boring, but the public librarians use those statistics extensively in their local budget decisions and in statewide comparisons. And then the facilitation that the state library does in the licensing of general information resources for the use by all Oregonians. But OLA also values the, and we use, the unique expertise of the state library, the state law library, and state archives. And as a library community, we support the collaboration among those three entities. Their information resources, their expertise, and their services enrich all of our lives. I'm a librarian. I'm now retired, and I think that libraries are really vital and essential to a well-informed citizenry and the government that serves it. And we can't forget that the state library primarily, and the first thing, is to serve state government and make sure that you have access to the information you need to make wise decisions. So I think that we recognize as an organization, we anticipate that this bill will help revitalize the state library, and we're interested in the proposed, how the proposed changes take shape. I'd like to thank Nathanson, Devlin, and Buckley for their work on this, because it's been a long process. So thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Phil Lemon. I'm representing the Oregon Judicial Department. With me is Catherine Bowie, who is the State of Oregon Law Librarian. The Judicial Department has been involved, I think, in most, if not all, of the efforts that Representative Nathanson has been involved in over the years, looking to improve coordination and efficiency of the state's research and reference services. So in addition to that work, in that collaborative work, the State of Oregon Law Library has been active in developing and negotiating new licensing agreements for specialized legal resources and subscriptions, and our work has accomplished not only reducing duplication but also lowering costs throughout state government, not just for the courts, who are our primary service users, but also for state lawyers in the Office of Public Defense Services, the Department of Justice, Legislative Council, Workers' Compensation Board, and others. And so we, and Catherine in particular, has made a concerted effort to spread that, to get broader licenses and lower the cost for all the attorneys who need that service. As Representative Nathanson said, there is additional work that can be done, so we are fully in support of Section 15, which creates a reference council with participation of the state librarian and the state archivist. Obviously, we appreciate the comments of Representative Nathanson and Senator Devlin about separating the State of Oregon Law Library and the Judicial Department from the executive branch functions here. And so those are the Dash 2 amendments, and those just, again, generally delineate the authority of the State Library and its board as it relates to the State of Oregon Law Library and county law libraries. And so I'd, without further ado, I'd be glad to answer questions.
Thank you. I am... I'm just open to any questions. I am hoping that the will accept the changes in the amendment. I think we've done some good work. I think it has been a long process, and I want to thank Madam Chair and...
Oh, please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm
record.
Sorry. I'm Catherine Bowie.
Thank you.
State Law Librarian. And I want to thank the Madam Chair and the members of the committee for taking this on. It's been a long road, and I think this bill will take care of a lot of the issues and get us moving forward. We have been continuing to move forward. We are embracing technology, looking at technology on how people access information resources, bringing it to them rather than having to come into a library, even removing the obstacle that they have to have a library card or register. We're looking at geospatial types of technology that limit it to the Oregon borders. So our primary work is with the state agencies, our experience, our education. This is all we do, and we deal with legal research, deal with confidential information, and the majority of our databases are just not open to the public. They are specialized. The public would not be able to understand them any more than they would a health sciences center special databases. So we speak the terminology. Our reference librarian has a JD, and that's basically what we do. But we reach out to all of the pockets of the legal staff and all of the agencies, and I think it's been working pretty well. They've been very receptive.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
I don't have a question. I just want to thank you. This looks like one of those pieces of work that, you know, it took a long time to get here, but like I get to arrive at the finish line and get a chance to vote on some very good cooperation and some really good goals, and it looks like there's going to be all kinds of successes in your future. I do want to say one thing, because I totally believe that whatever geospatial technology is, it's probably special, and I'm glad you have it, because it sounds like your library needs that type of technology. But I do want to recognize publicly that we need a lot of different types of libraries. And in Hillsborough, for example, we just started opening our library on Sunday because there's so many people who want to come to that library, and it's a community place. And people come there to visit and to read and to research and to work. And so I think we need all of us. So it's a good thing, but thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? And I will just attest, as an attorney who went to law school during the, like I said to you the other day, during the Westlaw Nexus Look It Up days, I could not, as an attorney, navigate, I'm sure, our state library, our state law library. So I appreciate that there are folks like you who, if I absolutely had to, if the internet went down and I had to go look up a case in a book with trepidation, that there are folks who could actually help me do that.
Paul, and we will walk you through it on the phone.
There we go. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next, I'm Mary Kay Dahlgren and Mary Beth Herbert. Herbert.
What is it?
Herkert. I'll just say, how about we have Mary Beth and Mary Kay? I like that. That was a total coincidence, but that worked out nicely.
It works great.
All right, go ahead and identify for yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Kay Dahlgren. I'm the state librarian. I'm here today to speak to House Bill 3523, which would change the governance structure of the Oregon State Library and allow implementation of several of the recommendations that were made by the 2011 Legislative Work Group on Libraries and Archives in Oregon State Government. From the perspective of the State Library, the changes to the State Library Board would allow broader input from all our patron bases and provide the added expertise of two of our partner agencies. The changes to the appointment of the State Librarian would bring that process in line with other agency director appointments while continuing to assure that professional library credentials are required. The other substantive changes appear in Section 15, Section 16, and Section 19. Those sections would create a state reference coordinating council, require state library approval and oversight of subscription databases and physical subscriptions, and require state library certification of other state agency libraries. Again, from the perspective of the state library, these changes were recommendations from the 2011 work group and are intended to increase efficiency and reduce duplication. We anticipate that these activities could be integrated into the work of the State Library with minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division. And I am also here to testify on this bill. But what we have submitted some clarifying amendments to further make clear the differentiation between the libraries and the archives, and we're just asking. We've submitted those, and we're just asking for the opportunity to have them reviewed before this bill passes. And we anticipate we'll have that all done before your next meeting. Thank you.
Questions for Mary Beth and Mary Kay? Seeing none, you guys got off easy. All right. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3523? Okay. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3523 and carry over the work session until Tuesday. And so we never got the paperwork for... Well, you're checking on that. I'm just going to, out of an abundance of caution, I'm going to go through the bills again that I've carried over. So carrying over House Bill 2019, carrying over House Bill 2617, House Bill 2255, carrying over, 2252, carrying over House Bill 2599, carrying over House Bill 3248, carrying over House Bill 3523, and also carrying over House Bill 3315. So with that, is there anything else for the good of the order?
Carried over 32. Did we do Senate Bill 353?
And I'm going to close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.